Well, good morning and good afternoon. Welcome to the Weber Training Teleclass, Critical Care Design, the Good, the Bad, and the Alternatives. My name is Paul Weber. It is a real honor to bring this teleclass to you today. Thanks very much for coming along. This topic was actually the special request of a few of you from last year, but we had to wait until we could find the absolute very best person to deliver it. Now, Karen Iverson is the manager of the Infection Prevention and Control Unit at the University Health Network in Toronto, Canada. She also serves as a member of the Canadian Standards Association Technical Subcommittee for Standards on Special Requirements for HVAC Systems in Healthcare Facilities. Karen is a nationally recognized expert in construction and design issues, particularly related to nosocomial infection. In fact, I would go so far as to say that she is absolutely the best person in the world to give this teleclass. This is the first of two teleclasses this year on hospital design and construction, and I'm really looking forward to it. So to give us the teleclass, Critical Care Design, the Good, the Bad, and the Alternatives from the University Health Network in Toronto, it is my privilege to present Karen Iverson. Karen.
Thank you, Paul. After that introduction, I hope I don't disappoint too much. I thought what I would do first is, before I get into the overview, is just tell you what our facility is like and what we're all about so you have an idea in general of what sort of experiences I've had, because the upcoming presentation is really going to be about my experiences and hopefully some helpful hints that people can think about or follow when they're designing various other types of facilities. The UHN is three buildings, three separate sites, which is Toronto General, Toronto Western, and Princess Margaret Hospital. All in Toronto, all downtown, within, you know, a few kilometers of each other. But Toronto General is basically a large organ transplant facility, so we have a lot of surgery going on here, a huge brand new operating room, and we just went through renovating whole inpatient and outpatient wings of our facility. And at the Western, we just finished building a new ambulatory wing, which is all just for clinics. And we're about to enter into renovating our ICU, and it's going to be a huge project. And I think that the experience I have is really gained from the fact that all of the funding for most of the projects that we've experienced has been internal from various other, you know, financial resources in the ministry. So our projects literally go from planning to design, development, and occupation within the span of 2 years. So from that, I'm able to be a part of all of the various layers of planning, design, construction, and occupying the space and seeing how things have been after a couple of years of planning. So I think we're very lucky in that lots of our planning has taken place over a very short period of time. And I recognize that a lot of people are in this place where they are planning 1 year, and then 6 years down the road, they finally get what they've designed. So there's lots of challenges ahead. So I'll get right into the talk, which is an overview, and which covers basically one of the lessons that we learned from a new dialysis unit that we built. I'm also, of course, going to talk about negative pressure isolation rooms. Is one of my favorite things. We have probably in our Toronto General site alone about 36 of these, which is an amazing feat in itself. And then I'll also talk to you about ICU design considerations and what your priorities might be. We just finished building a 36-bed unit over here at the Toronto General, and we're about to embark on designing a 25-bed unit at the Toronto Western, which we are now in the planning and design phases of. So it's a lot to learn, and I'm glad that I was able to build one, learn from my mistakes, and build the next. So going on to slide 3, which is the personal encounters hemodialysis slide, I'll get right into the hemo problem. So the way our hemodialysis unit was designed was that they would have a pod of four chairs for each hemodialysis patient, and they wouldn't be side by side. They sort of had their own little niche, and then there would be a nursing station decentralized to where they were. And this was great, and we said, okay, we're going to go with a ratio of one sink to every four chairs, which was fine. But given that real estate is always a challenge, we needed to find a sink that was able to be put onto a column in the area. And the problem with that was that we found that the only little sinks that we could find actually sprayed water everywhere and people were slipping and things. So first lesson there was try to make sure that you're looking at how big your sink bowl is, how large your faucet neck is, and just maybe even try it out or have a look and see what they're like before you actually buy them. Because we ended up buying quite a few given that we have almost 50 hemodialysis beds, chairs in that unit. The more the larger problem that we had with this hemodialysis was that previous hemodialysis units we had all of our water connections coming from the machine, so all of the exudate or whatever you'd like to call it, going directly into a hard connection of plumbing, and then the supply was also a hard connection. Now, when we went to design this, we were told by the designers that we could no longer have that direct connection because it violated one of the Ontario building codes. And I'm not sure if this applies to the same, is the same across for the national building code, but it may very well be. Long story short, what ended up happening is that because we had to design a stainless steel box that we call a hemo box, that had an open plumbing system, we ended up actually having an outbreak of Enterococcus casulaflavus. So our patients were being almost sprayed by things, organisms that were growing in the drain. So I'll get to some more information. So the next slide is the OBC, and you don't need to read through this, and I'm not going to read through it with you, but I had to search long and hard to try and find exactly what the OBC was saying to say that we could not have this hard connection. And it says in this list here that for these reasons you cannot have a hard connection. So I'll go into the next slide, which is the picture of our hemodialysis machine and the drain boxes. And I'm not sure if you're able to see it, but if you look at the picture of the hemodialysis machine, it's connected to, just to the right of it, you'll see this little black box that's recessed into our little alcove made of laminate there. And the drain, which is a smaller picture up close, has the connection from the RO water on the top left, and then the bottom right is where the machine was hooked into for the water to drain out after it had filtered through the body. So if you go to the next slide, it's a blow-up of the actual hemodialysis drain box, and I put a little circle around where you can see that the water is actually coming out of the hose and falling into this box and then going into the black hole, which is the drain. So this is, if you can imagine, where the problem arose. We wanted to have this actual piece of plumbing plugged right into the wall and not sort of dripping behind a wall, but right into a hard connection, and we couldn't do that. So this was our option. Now, part of our designing, we had met with some of the consultants and the mechanical consultants and said, you know, we want some doors or something put on here, but it never seemed to be something that could be rationalized from a design perspective. So we were stuck to our own devices. And if you go to the next slide, we have the solution. So what we ended up having to do was actually put our own sort of splash guard box, made it of stainless steel, on top of that drain so that we could prevent further spread from going on. Now, I give credit to the infection control practitioners in our department that looked long and hard at how this was spreading, and there was an investigation and lots of interesting conclusions drawn. So if there's anybody interested, I could always put you in touch with that practitioner onto the investigation they endured. But long story short, I think, is make sure that when you are dealing with this type of client anyway, you need to devise a way that is clean, dry, and won't really expose anybody to any splashes from the drain or any dirty water. So that's the story from the hemodialysis. The next slide, which is slide number 8, I'm getting into our personal experience with designing our ICU. So the good news was that when I arrived in this position, they were just about to renovate the medical surgical ICU here, which is predominantly medicine and transplant intensive care patients. And we had a clean floor plate, and we were able to do whatever we liked with it. So we put all single rooms in, and we were short for space. So instead of having hoppers in every room, which is what they originally, some of the designers wanted, we said, no, you can't have an actual hopper in the room. You need to put it behind a closed door. But the only way to achieve that was by you'd be losing some square footage. So we had to put them in the back of the room shared between two bedrooms. So two single rooms, we basically have a walk-through where they share the hopper in the back. Now, this is a good thing there, but what this led us to was that we really needed to design our pitch to redesign basically our Toronto Western ICU, because our Toronto Western ICU was last renovated in 1984, and it has 23 beds but only three single rooms. So we had four-bedded rooms, and there was outbreaks, and we had some problems with that space. And not to mention that we had a look at how many times a patient was moved around in that area, and we showed that during a regular stay, a person at the Toronto Western would move 4.53 times compared to somebody at the Toronto General, where we had single rooms. because they were needed to move for various procedures or isolations or whatever else it may be. So this is a problem because it's a lot of resources needed to do that kind of moving. So the problem with getting the Toronto Western IC renovated was that there was no money, and there never seemed to be enough to make the needed changes. So initially we met for a year and said, let's get rid of the carpet that we have in the nursing station and let's put some walls in and try to make a better situation out of a not-so-great situation. But the reality was that we recognized that these Band-Aid measures were not going to be adequate to really resolve the actual problem that we had there. So we did do a report that was provided to our administrators, including information such as the bed moves and everything else, and the fact that we had no negative pressure monitoring and that our mechanical systems had been evaluated and weren't up to par. And we showed as well that there actually had been some staff exposures to tuberculosis in that area because the ventilation and everything, the design was just so old. So with that, they agreed and said that they would support going forward. So I'll be getting back to that in a little bit. But the good news is we're now designing our new Toronto Western ICU. Now, on the next slide, I'm just giving you a little bit of detail about what our Toronto General ICU design actually looks like. This is the new one that just got built and was occupied, I think, as of July of 2004. Now, the new construction with that space is great because we have 36 beds, all singles. We have 6 negative pressure rooms. We have 28 single rooms and 1 double room, actually, just because of the landscape. That was the only way we could fit it. And all of the rooms are on the exterior of the wing, so every room has natural light. And we also have large glass doors where people are able to observe the patient from the outside of the room. And when you get to the next slide, I show you pictures of, on the left-hand side, which is the new ICU at the Toronto General, which has the long, clean, nice, wide corridors with not very much. And then on the right-hand side of the slide is the Med-Surg ICU at the Toronto Western. And the next slide is just another picture of the Med-Surg ICU at the Western, and it shows a looking into a 4-bedded room and how cluttered and difficult it is and really how awful it would be to try and monitor all of the patients at the same time and have everything that gets accumulated in there. The next slide is just another picture of the Toronto Western, which shows you probably can't see the carpeting and all of the other various required monitoring equipment that you have nowadays with new technology. And so these things were things that we really wanted to try and accommodate into the new design. So your next slide shows at the top left how we managed to develop a space in the Toronto General ICU that has viewing stations outside the patient room but allows the nursing staff to actually visualize into two separate patient rooms so they can cross-cover if somebody needs to leave. And the bottom right slide was actually a picture of how the nursing station was set up to visualize a patient in the Toronto Western ICU, and it really shows that all you can see from sitting in here is their feet, so it wasn't a very helpful observation point. Now, on the next slide, I show pictures of how we accommodated the knowledge of having the hemodialysis problem in the ICU. So what we had learned from having hemodialysis patients, a large population of them here, is that one, we couldn't design the drains the same way as we had before, and the other that we were going to need to accommodate hemodialysis in the inpatient rooms in the ICU because what we had learned was that the only way that portable hemodialysis could occur would be to plug in the hemodialysis machine to the actual hand washing sink in the ICU room, which rendered the ICU sink not useful for several hours for regular hand washing and also meant that you were draining a lot of really dirty, well, not necessarily dirty because not really dirty exudate, but it was still draining into the sink and not running or useful. So what we did was in the inpatient areas of the new wing, we put these boxes on the left-hand side that actually have doors so they can be cleaned and sterilized at the end of the day. Well, not sterilized, but treated with chemicals at the end of the day. And then on the right-hand side, it shows a similar box, but that was incorporated into the head wall of our new ICU design at the Toronto General. So instead of going with an actual head wall on the wall, we ended up going with a freestanding wall column in the middle of the room that houses all of our gases and everything else in the hemodialysis box at the bottom. Now on the next slide, it shows what our original layout of the patient room looks like. And so you can see, you know, the entrances are side by side at the bottom. Now, on the far left bottom corner and the far right bottom corner, there is a picture that has a crossed out sink. So what happened there was we had decided that we needed not only a sink for hand washing, but we wanted to have a sink for utility services, you know, drying baths and getting anything done, like washing washcloths for patient baths and everything else like that. And we didn't want that sink that was going to be a utility sink to be the hand washing sink. So we had two sinks initially designed into the room, one of them right in the middle of the space where the sinks are back to back, one in one room, one in the other, and then the two right by the door. And basically, by virtue of cost and the fact that it seemed really extravagant to have two sinks per room, the sinks by the door were actually eliminated. And that ended up being not something that was so great for us, and I'll get to that in a second. But at the back, in the middle, you can see where the hopper is. It's that square, and it's accessible from both patient rooms. Now, there are doors there. It doesn't appear that on the floor plan here, but there is doors that close off the hopper from the main patient room. So in the next slide is a picture of what our sinks look like in the ICU. And if you can see it on the side, there is actually a countertop. And the thing that's nice about these sinks is they're stainless steel. They're freestanding. They have foot pedals. They're automatic, you know, in that sense. And they have a nice backsplash integrated into it. And we thought these sinks were excellent. But what we have since experienced is some interesting organisms have started to grow in our sink. And if you go to the next slide, it shows what we've had to do as a result. So we've ended up shutting down a lot of our sinks because we've identified a multi-drug resistant organism in there that we're concerned may expose patients in the future. And although it's a good distance from the head of the patient bed and the patient stretcher, we're really worried about what we're going to do going forward with this organism because we have seen the same organism in the patients. So it's interesting to see how we can move forward. Now, the interesting part about this sink is, if you go to the next slide, is what leads me into faucets and aerators. So, you know, our environmentalists are constantly, and different standards are trying to get us to move towards water reduction and saving strategies, which are good, and a lot of the faucet moderators, or those screwed-on sieve-like adapters for faucets, are great in the sense that they reduce a lot of flow, but at the same time, for infection control reasons, we're very concerned with them because they don't typically get removed and cleaned as frequently as they need to, and have been associated with the aerosolization of organisms and resulting in infections in patients. So in our circumstance here, the aerators actually had been installed onto the sinks to help with control of the flow because the water pressure was very high. And as part of our control measures to make sure that we weren't spreading anything in the environment, we removed the aerator. But as a result, we've had much higher water flow in these sinks. And when you wash your hands, we did a little test where we showed that the spray of our water from our hands is actually going almost 3 feet away from the sink. In addition to that, because the water is so high and the water flow goes directly from the faucet into the drain itself, we're really worried about any organisms that would grow in the drain, because you would expect to find some being forced out and spraying onto any clean setup that might be on that countertop next door to it. So this is a challenge that we are currently facing. So although we have a brand new place, not everything has worked out exactly the way we thought. Now in the next slide, I have a picture of a concept that was developed by one of the architects we're working with now for the Toronto Western. And what they're proposing is having ICU rooms that are all single in pods of four, where the viewing stations are very similar to how we have it at the Toronto General, where they're sitting outside the room and two nurses are sharing sort of the visual points there. But they have also broken down this slide into a color coding of drawing attention to, you know, where the clean area of the room is and where we're going to be disposing of wastes and where the family will be, because now we would all like to make sure that family is available to be there for support of the patient. So what this leads me into is not only waste disposal, but also patient chairs and the use of fabrics in healthcare. It might seem like a tangent, but it's something that comes up all of the time, where we renovated one of our palliative care floors and they bought a whole bunch of lounging chairs for the unit. And there was a lot of proposal by various consultants to say, you know, here's my antimicrobial fabric, and it's great, it's wipeable, and it's water resistant. And the reality of it was that we took a piece of this fabric back with us and threw some yogurt on it and did some tests and showed that even though it might be water resistant, you can't clean it. And most infection control people know that if you can't clean something, it can never be fully disinfected. So we were sort of disappointed with what choice we had gone with, and have since moved to fabrics that are more vinyl based. And the nice, I guess, the cooperation or the midpoint that I've been able to reach with a lot of the consulting designers that we deal with here is that they would like the fabric that's pretty and colored and designed, but doesn't come in vinyl, obviously. So what we have said as a rule is you can put the fabric nice design pattern, as long as it's not sort of shaggish, on the back panel of the chair, but the seat part of the chair must be vinyl, because this is a horizontal surface where everything's going to be falling and need to be wiped off. And this has actually been met with agreement by a lot of the designers and has made us very happy, because our housekeeping can clean it and it doesn't get soiled and doesn't get stained. Now, the next slide goes to the other area, which is disposal of dirty and contaminated items in a patient room. So our challenge with our Toronto General ICU was we recognized that because of the intensity of care needed for a lot of the ICU patients, the nurses don't have time to take a dirty bedpan or a dirty item down the hall and dump it into a traditional hopper. So our concept was to have those hoppers in between patient rooms and share them in the hope that this would be, you know, local disposal and everything would work out great. But, you know, it ended up being that there was more happening in a room that's a disposal. There were some even antibiotics being drained into sinks or even when they're priming lines, a lot of things that we wouldn't consider necessarily super clean activities that were then being dumped into the sink. So we recognize that, you know, it's not just having a hopper for, you know, bedpans and that type of soiled things. You really do need another source for dumping of some of extra liquids and waste from patient activities. The problem with waste disposal in rooms is you want it close to be accessible, but you don't want it too close to be a source of cross-contamination. So what's the best thing to do? And if you want to have local access, it's a lot more money because you're providing that many more items and devices. So where do you put it? How many waste receptacles should you have? A lot of these things aren't listed in the standards that I typically go to, like AIA or CSA or Health Canada or anything like that, or the OBC or ASHRAE. These things that I think that a lot of us really want to know about don't exist. And it's made it for a lot of learning experiences on my part. One experience that we had was that we installed hands-free sinks, which were great everywhere, but they were connected to electrical by a plug that was an emergency backed up. So when we had our blackout last year, 50% of the sinks in our brand new building didn't work. So we had challenges there. So I guess the thing to consider there is maybe go with foot pedals like we've tried to do for hands-free devices in our ICU, or try to wire all of your sinks to emergency backup, but that's probably going to be quite expensive. Now, on the next slide, I'm just listing, showing you various examples, the next slide being 22 and then the one following that, which is 23. Those are just pictures of different types of waste. So there's, you know, the macerator type, which uses the recyclable cardboard formed type waste, and then you put it into a receptacle that basically destroys not only the holder but all the waste inside of it. And the next slide has a different kind of machine, which is actually a bedpan washer disinfector. So you put in the bedpan full of waste, insert it, and it dumps the waste and cleans and disinfects and allows you to take the bedpan back and use it again. And the other one being the traditional hopper, which we call like a glorified toilet bowl with no seat, and would allow any nursing staff to basically spray out the bedpan. And we're finding here that these are becoming less and less popular. And although we installed them to be accessible, they're being met with resistance from a lot of the staff because they're just not, it doesn't seem like to be the cleanest way of disposing of things. In our new ICU at the Toronto Western, we're exploring the idea of going with the washer disinfector bedpans in the hopes that they will reduce the amount of transportation needed sort of to courier the bedpans down to our central processing area to be cleaned and reprocessed and sent back up. And it also prevent nursing staff from having to go to a clean utility room or a dirty utility room to constantly dump and get a new bedpan. So this is one of our attempts, and I can always feed you back with our how things have become to fruition after this place gets built. But in the next slide, the reason I listed this was just that it's a quote from the AIAA saying that a soiled workroom or soiled holding room, it shall contain a clinical sink or equivalent flushing rim fixture. If the flushing rim clinical sink is eliminated, facilities for cleaning and bedpans shall be provided elsewhere. So that just basically justifies what I was saying before. We're all at a loss and confused as to how many do we need, where do they need to go, and what's the best kind to use. And I don't know if there is an answer to that question, but it's certainly something that I think everybody in the design phase really needs to think about a lot, because it's come up quite a bit over here. In the next slide, I have a list of questions that are things that come into mind when you're thinking about waste disposal, and it's just, how do you feel about transporting waste through the hall? Is this something that's not very common in your patient population, or do you have waste all the time? I think the frequency needs to be considered, and I think that infers really where then you will put your disposal mechanism. Will it be centrally or locally located? There have been some documented literature that discusses commodes and built-in units, and I have heard of units that sort of swivel out from the bed. So the patient bed is there, and then you can press a button and out pops sort of a toilet seat, and you, I guess, can roll your patient over and get them to use that. But I personally haven't seen these in use, but they have been documented and not been highly regarded. So I would put a personal warning on those. And do you want your disposal unit to be a disinfector or a disposal unit? Do you want to just dump everything? That could be a personal choice as well. One thing that I've kept in my mind with these is that if you do go with the permanently disposable, you have boxes and boxes of these cardboard forms that need to be stored somewhere. So that's one thing. Versus the other type of unit, which requires actually a lot of maintenance of these units to make sure they are functioning properly, which is for the non-disposable one. And I think the other key point here is that often isolation rooms get sort of mixed into the regular trend of the same template of all the inpatient rooms, but isolation rooms always need their dedicated disposal area. So even if you go with a centralized disposal waste system, you really need to have a local disposal system for the IC room itself, because you don't want to be lugging anything infectious down the hall. So in the next slide, which is slide 26, we have what we've learned. So one of them is we would really like our hand washing sinks in our ICU closer to the door, and this is traditionally the design that you have. It was just that in our design, since we had two, one of them got eliminated, and it got eliminated before we really had a chance to think about it. The other thing is that our floor plate is actually quite small, and we realize we need much more room in our ICU here. So the new ICU at the Western, they are going to be going with an articulating arm instead of a column head wall or even a traditional head wall. Some of my experience with sliding doors has been that we've had a lot of difficulty getting them to work very well, because sometimes when installing them, the floor doesn't lie level, and the sliders have been broken, and some of ours are permanently jammed open, and some of them are permanently closed. And although they're great for visualizing the patient, because we were able to provide that nursing station with the viewing windows, we don't really find that a lot of people are viewing the patient from the actual hallway anyway. So I think going forward, we'd probably move towards a harder door with just regular windows in it. And the reason that I also mentioned the sliding doors is that in other areas of this particular hospital, not in the ICU, we did renovate some rooms to negative pressure rooms, and they had sliding doors, and we are having a really hard time maintaining the negative pressure because of an inadequate seal on the sliding door. So that's something else to keep in mind. Method of waste disposal, we probably wouldn't do a shared concept anymore, and we know that the hoppers aren't a big hit around a lot of places. I'm sure that a hopper, I know that we have hoppers in other areas like, a regular inpatient ward where it's centralized, and they don't find the need for a lot of them, where the patients are ambulatory and getting up to go to the bathroom anyway. So something centralized might be a good idea for that type of patient population, but in our circumstances for the ICU, we know that we need something a lot more dedicated. One other thing that has come to mind for our design of our ICU here is that because of the way that the actual floor was designed, we weren't able to have a dedicated exhaust system per se installed with our negative pressure rooms. So we had to install, obviously, a HEPA filter exhaust area so that all the air coming from the isolation room gets exhausted through HEPA filters and gets put into the other a general exhaust area. But the challenge we've had with this is that since we have 8 alone just on our step down and our ICU side, or 6 I should say, it's made for a lot of maintenance because the filters have to constantly be monitored and changed out. And what we realize is that the location of the dampers to remove these filters is really, really awkward. And a couple slides from now, I'll be showing you pictures of what that looks like. But I will come back to that in a minute. Second last from this is that we decided in this design that people would like to move towards having rooms that were all very similar in clinical function so that there was more flexibility for moving people around. And this has been really great, and we're going to go with that design as well in the new ICU where all the rooms will be the same. So if you ever need to sort of expand your program, you can go into those rooms without having to invest a lot of money to upgrade your gases and your oxygen and things like that. And one other thing that we're talking in plans now is that before even designing your whole area, we're thinking of talking about mechanical issues before the architectural design gets laid out, because sometimes the architectural design will limit your HVAC or vice versa, in that sometimes ductwork falls really low from the ceiling based on, you know, ceiling to slab heights and dimensions. And so sometimes where people, designers, design the space and then bring in the consultants, it's almost better to bring in the consultants and then have the architecture go hand in hand at the same time. Would be a worthwhile exercise in a lot of cases. So the next slide is slide number 27, and it talks more thoroughly about the negative pressure rooms and the idea of mechanical design. A lot of people, and I've talked to a lot of colleagues about this too, they've had a really hard time trying to get the negative pressure rooms to actually stay negative. And some of the circumstances I've seen is that after the room gets built and you go look at it, you can get an idea before it's at the stage of sort of occupancy that the room isn't really fully sealed and there's holes from one room to another to run ductwork or cables. And this isn't necessarily the greatest thing. So I would caution people to really have a look at how well the room is sealed. And also the use of the anti-rooms. There's the option to have the anti-room being the only door access to the isolation room where the patient and the staff have to go through the same anteroom. But there's also the option of having a shared anteroom or an anteroom aside from the 4 or 5 foot door you need to get the bed in. And we've had experience where when you have a big door, they use the big door and skip over the anteroom. So that's something to keep in mind as you go forward as well. The general exhaust versus the HEPA exhaust is something that I was just touching on in the last slide about our ICU and how we've had to deal with that. And in my next slide, I'll talk about that in a second. But the issue with this is based on how you develop your mechanical design is really going to outline how you're going to be able to maintain the space and make sure the rooms are negative all the time. So be sure that there are proper monitoring things in place. And for our particular rooms, we do have red light, green light sort of function and alarms, as well as a magnetic gauge, which will tell us how cluttered our filter is getting, so we know whether or not the filter needs to be changed. So on the next slide is my very, very basic drawing of a dedicated versus a general exhaust design. So on the left-hand side, there's all these, I don't think it's probably black and white for you, but a whole bunch of squares basically stacked on top of each other with arrows going into a long, a tall stack. And what this is, it's a very overgeneralized design, picture that basically all of the rooms here, this is the way one of our wings at our Toronto General is designed, is that each of those rooms are actually negative pressure rooms. So on every floor, the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th floor, we have a negative pressure room exactly the same design stacked on top of each other. And the nice thing about this was that the entire wing design was thought of right from the get-go, and they were able to give a specific fan dedicated just to exhausting the air from these isolation rooms. And that's the best way to do it. And the only way it should really be done. However, there are some other possible options when you're trying to just attain negative pressure, and the way that that was achieved on our ICU upstairs is the picture on the right, which shows a row of rooms that aren't negative pressure, but then these two single rooms that are sitting below them. And what's happened here is that they're all sharing almost the same exhaust, but we don't want them to share the same, because if there's ever a problem, there could be backflow from the fans or from pressure, and then it would cause actual air from those that return to blow back into patient room that's not isolated. So the way that that is fixed is by putting in HEPA filters on all of the air that's leaving the isolation rooms. But the challenge that we've had with this is, if you go to the next slide, properly what they've done is they've installed these bubble-tight dampers. So it's a big stainless steel vessel that houses the HEPA filter. And what you need to do is the dampers of this room need to be shut down and the fan needs to be turned off for us to service it. And the filter in there is contained within a bag for safety reasons, and you're able to pull out the bag and then reinsert a new one without really touching the filter. And this is great, but what we found is, in this picture it's not too clear, but in certain areas of our hospital, these dampers were installed before our water sprinkler system was put in. So when we get up there to open it, there's a sprinkler head right in front of the damper, and everything was a mess. So a lot of construction would have actually had to be done to remediate all the clutter in the ceiling so that we could actually get the filter out. Now, on the next slide, to just show a picture of some of the maintenance staff of our facility trying to gain access to these dampers. And in this particular room, it's actually a clinic room in one of our transplant clinics, is where we have a damper for a negative pressure room. And they're inside the room trying to get this filter out. And that's good in one way, in that it's contained. They can shut the door, seal it off, and make sure that nobody's exposed to the ceiling space and everything else like that. But it's also bad in that you can't use the space when you're maintaining it. The other challenge with that was that in a lot of cases our dampers were in the hallway right outside of a patient room, so we've had to set up an elaborate or some sort of control cube above the space, and these plant operations people are trying to manipulate around this 4 foot by 2 foot giant HEPA filter and trying to wiggle it out, and it's really quite challenging. So the way to avoid that is if you can get a dedicated system that has a centralized filter somewhere, it would be very worthwhile looking into if you ever have the opportunity to do that. Changing paces just a little bit, on the next slide we have a picture of our TB clinic, and I included this in here because it's very—it's just a new idea that we hadn't seen anywhere else, but thought would be very helpful. And some of the mechanical consultants that were working on this with us, contributed to the idea of getting what we have here. And what that is we have a bank of 8 negative pressure exam rooms. And although that seems it might be a little bit elaborate, it's quite handy because the way it's designed is that the exam rooms can be used for regular day-to-day clinics, which they are throughout the week. The TB clinic only runs 2 days a week. But during the use of the TB clinic, these end doors, one at the far end of the hallway and the one closest to the picture, they're shut, and they have monitors just outside the door to say whether or not it's negative pressure. And this whole bank of rooms just goes right into a dedicated exhaust system, which is really easy to help maintain the pressure and doesn't require individual monitoring on every single exam room. So essentially the space is one giant negative pressure bubble, and the hallway is a big anteroom. So we've had much better success in maintaining the static pressure differential and the negative pressure in these spaces than I think we would have if we had provided these, elaborate, maybe over-detailed, monitors at every single doorway for an exam room that's in use maybe once or twice a week. The next slide is just a quick picture of the other concept that we included in the design of the TB clinic, and that was having a dedicated waiting area for the tuberculosis clinic patients. So when they come into the main waiting room, which is a seating area of 30 to 40 people waiting to go into various clinics, they have a space in multiple languages that says, please go in here, and where they can see through this glass window to the nursing station, communicate with the receptionist, and wait to be admitted into the clinic, and they can sit in this negative pressure waiting room, which is great. So moving on to the next slide, which just covers really me talking about different things that you probably want to think about in all areas of the space. And the challenge that we've had here is not only building from brand new, which is most of what I've shown you, but also redeveloping spaces. So I'm sure most people, this is the scenario for most other people that are listening in, where you have a clinic or a doctor's offices and they want to change it into a procedure room or a dentistry procedure room. And the fact is that when you're trying to accommodate a lot of features by a renovation, it's difficult to do without a lot of money. And sometimes because you are just renovating a space, you're not necessarily forced into abiding by a lot of the new guidelines, because a lot of the new guidelines say in renovations, you know, thou shalt do this, and in new developments, you know, thou shalt do this. But a lot of the times we found that the HVAC or the ventilation systems weren't addressed as part of this renovation, and then you'd end up getting areas that would typically need a better circulation, like a procedure room or something, and was getting much less than that, and there were issues for occupational health and safety and other, obviously other concerns as well. I highlighted in bold where to build is a redevelopment, because we recently renovated a very large advanced medical imaging really center at the Toronto Western, and it was deemed to be built on top of our existing 14 operating rooms. And when you're building, you know, CT, MRI, angio, and advanced large-scale magnetic instruments like that, they need to be not only shipped in a very hard way, but also bolted down, fastened, and drilled into the slab that they're being stationed upon, as well as, you know, lead-lined walls and a lot of detailed, extensive structural surroundings to these things. And if you can imagine, any of the slightest vibration on top of an operating room can be extremely challenging. And we did survive it. I could always share with anybody how we managed to do that, but it was not pleasant. And fortunately, we had no outbreaks or any patient issues as a result of that construction, but I can tell you that any person in this hospital would tell you that they would never do it again. So try to keep that in mind. Think about how elaborate your project is going to be and what's below it and sometimes what is above it. The next thing that I'm sure a lot of people have experienced and are constantly wondering about is whether or not when you're renovating a space for the purpose of gaining more negative pressure rooms, do you buy a portable unit and plug it into your existing system, or do you have a mobile unit, or do you pay and get a brand new fan and renovate and get a brand new negative pressure room? That is an option that will probably be limited by cost for most facilities, but I think that the key message for this is that really everybody needs to consider that there is a lot of monitoring and maintenance that needs to go into the HEPA units that you buy. And so that before anybody proceeds going that route of getting a special adapted isolation room, I should say, there really needs to be a lot of thought put into it from a maintenance perspective, and how do you change out the filters and how will plant operations monitor it. And it's quite complicated and can cause some problems. So just keep that in mind as well. And I think that the last thing with this slide is you really need to take a consideration as to when it is appropriate to redevelop a space versus when it really needs to be redone. And we faced this with our Toronto Western ICU, where we spent a year and had a budget going into it to really just Band-Aid solution it, and it came down to the fact that this would never be able to remedy the problems we were having. So we needed to go the full way, and it took 3 years to even get to the point where we were able to pitch for more money to renovate the project, but we got it, and it is worthwhile, I think, in a lot of areas that desperately need it. Now, in the next slide, I just briefly touch on patient spacing issues, and this is a common other experience that we have here, and we're really trying to avoid as much as possible having tons of multi-bedded rooms, and we know that there's things like PACUs or holding areas or multi-bedded, you know, cath lab recovery rooms where it's sort of short-term stay in and out areas where it's much more practical to have an open concept. But for us, we're trying to avoid as much as we can going forward, continuing to have six-bedded rooms. And essentially, some of our step-down units for post-surgical procedures are multi-bedded rooms. So some of the challenges that we faced in trying to figure out how to manage this was that we said, you know, why don't we split our six-bedded room into two three-bedded rooms? And they would always say we can't afford it, and the single rooms would be great, but it's really difficult to do, to manage with nursing ratios, and that's not how our nursing ratio works. And so this is a challenge, and we're not saying that it's not, but I think that going in the future, I think things will need to really change, and I think that as long as we're working sort of with the nursing staff to try and figure out ways that everybody can be happy, it can be achieved. A lot of what I've experienced with step-down units is that, you know, if you go to, say, AIA or somebody try to give you guidance on what, how many beds can you have in one of these spaces, there really isn't anything out there that tells you what you should and shouldn't have. So what we've decided to do is just separate it down into something that's manageable. And in the next slide, there's a picture of our old step-down unit. And if you can see here, there's, you know, six boxes, and those were our beds. And in between that U of bed design, there's actually a nursing station. And these patients were really almost on top of each other. And it was very, very awkward and uncomfortable in there. And we were very concerned because there were, you know, we had had transmission in there. Nothing severe, but it happens when you're sharing a room full of with six people. So in the next picture, the next slide, I should say, is slide 36 is where we came to terms with our nursing staff. And what they had originally wanted to do was basically build the exact same unit in the same floor space. But what we had insisted upon was that that's not something that would be the best practice for everybody. So what we managed to do was get a little bit of extra space by taking on another office next door and breaking down two old patient rooms into the new step down. And the way it is, on the left-hand side, you have two beds and a little nursing station with a box and then the bathroom at the top. And then you have another on the other side of the crooked wall, which is a clear glass wall, so the nursing staff in the middle can still cross-cover all six beds. On the right-hand side, we have four more beds and its own dedicated bathroom. And the staff are really happy with this new space. It's much more roomy. We've still managed to deal with how the nurses are able to cover for each other without it being two separate rooms as far as, you know, full wall barriers. But we do have a full wall going in there with glass so they can see. Now the next slide, which is my very last slide, is really, now that I've really talked about all these different problems and challenges that we all have and in guidelines and interpretation of the guidelines, where do we go next? And from what I understand, there is some development of Canadian standards about to come. But I think that for the meantime, the only thing that most of us can do is really investigate what works for you. I mean, we have one facility with a lot of beds and a lot of critical care, but every facility is different, and their client and their visitors and their patients are going to be a lot different. So really try to take the time to go to the floors and see how nursing staff are actually disposing of waste now and ask questions about what their biggest challenges are. And if you have the capacity to do infection control surveillance, we've been able to incorporate that into our feedback and show them rates and concerns, and that really helps justify some of our recommendations. We found that very helpful. And really try to design what will work or maybe even possibly design something that you want to work and think about how things can change in the future. So at that, I'm finished, and I will turn it back to you, Paul.
Thank you very much, Karen. I honestly had no idea there were so many things to consider in the design of a hospital space. Regarding the comment on cost, I know it comes up all the time. We can't afford this. That costs too much. It's a real shame that somewhere there isn't a study that says if we didn't do these things, if we didn't do infection control, this is what it would cost because of all the extra hospital-acquired infections. Are you aware of any research that looks at the cost of not doing hospital-acquired infection prevention?
There's nothing that I know of that's really addressed that type of thing exactly the way you've described it. So there has been research that shows sort of we made a new design and it's shown decreased rates of infection. And whether or not that's exactly attributed is very hard to prove.
Yeah.
So there's things that show that. And I know that there's also research that shows if you don't contain a nosocomial infection, or if you don't treat it or isolate it, then it could result in more cases, and that could also be a cost, which is the worst cost, the cost for treating more people with illness or paying up front for preventative measures. So there's things that address that too, but I don't know of anything that exactly goes to say that this design measure helps save this money in that context, yeah.
I think that would be a pretty tough study to design. One last thing before I open the phone for questions. Carpeting.
Mm-hmm.
There is still carpeting. And even in the new facilities or newly designed hospitals, there is carpeting.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling on carpet versus hard floor?
Well, I'm just experiencing this with another project I'm helping people work on, and there's a whole bunch of viewpoints. So some of them are it helps with noise. It is safer for elderly if they fall, you know, to reduce injuries as a result of falling. And it is better for people who are trying to rehabilitate, who try to learn how to maneuver on carpeting and things like that. Then the flip side of that is, well, in addition to that, there's also people that pitch carpeting that's antimicrobial and things like that. Now, from what I understand, there has been some literature where they've shown that after the first washing, that antimicrobial property has been removed. So I haven't really studied that at length, but I have heard of it and seen it. That's one side of it. And then the other side of it is it's easier to clean, it's easier to maintain, and that's really it. It's easier to clean and it's easier to maintain. So I personally try to avoid it at all costs. We do have it in areas like some waiting rooms where it's not a high-risk area, but we've definitely said absolutely no way do we have any type of carpeting in a clinical space where a patient's receiving care, for example, an inpatient room or any procedure room or any exam room or any patient care space. Extenuating areas, you know, offices or exam rooms or even consultation rooms or lounges, we've said, okay, you can use them for the reasons they offer some comfort, but we've definitely tried to avoid them.
You were talking about the stainless steel sink in your ICU and that it was growing bugs in the sink area and you had to close it. Did you find out what about the sink was the problem?
No. We're currently investigating that, and I don't necessarily think that it's the sink itself. Well, I don't think it's the sink. We don't think that it's the sink itself that encouraged the growth of this organism. That we don't think that's what it is. What we think it is the environment around the sink that might have lended to being either exposed to exposing the sink to these organisms. So by maybe people draining things into the sink that they shouldn't have, or possibly having the sink then spread things out into the environment. You know, we're still investigating exactly the connection between the two, but I'm not saying, like, we are thinking about replacing some of the plumbing, and we have tried lots of different cleaning measures. What we are going to also do is reduce a lot of the flow, like I said. So we're not necessarily saying change out the sink, but really look at the practices of how the sink is used and also try to prevent spray.
Okay, yeah, because we were being asked whether we could go away from stainless steel in some areas and go to laminate around sink areas like in ORs and utility rooms.
We've had that proposal as well a lot. I personally really try to stay away from having clinical sinks, like sinks used for clinical use, within a laminate countertop, because if it's suspended within a laminate, a lot of the time the space underneath is sort of enclosed into cabinets, and water does drip. There's condensation and everything else. And the area underneath there isn't clean for use anyway. So we've gone with the freestanding sink in high-risk areas like the ICU, where there's a lot of equipment being pushed around quickly, vents, beds, monitors, dialysis machines, all sorts of things, crash carts. We kept with the stainless steel in the ICU because we've had instances where things have cracked and broken, so that's why I went with stainless there. I try to separate laminate and water as much as I can, just as a rule of thumb.
We're in the middle of building a new ICU. My question is, have you got any information about the different types of flooring that might be help to mitigate the effects of the cement underflooring?
That's a good question. We have tried a couple. One of them wasn't necessarily to deal with the cement, because the ones we have now we don't have a problems with, and it's just a regular vinyl sheet flooring. That's what we've been using in our ICU. We've had more problems with a marmoleum-type flooring. Another one that we tried, and I could get the name for you, but it was installed before I was here, and it was almost a thicker type of synthetic floor, like a type of sheet flooring, and it was put in to reduce sound because there's a lot of echo and there's a lot of activity in the ICU, but the problem with it was that it made it really hard to push equipment on because it was so, I guess there was a little bit more of an absorbency to it. So if you do come across one that is a little bit more absorbent to maybe deal with a cement, that would be one of the questions I would pose, is how it is to wheel things on it. personally, from my experience, I haven't had any dealings with special leveling products or anything, no.
Okay, we just have, you know, with our nursing, the aging of our nursing population, we're getting a lot of incidents now of plantar fasciitis, which the footwear itself doesn't seem to do a lot. So I was just curious whether there's anything as far as the actual flooring yourself that you're aware of. Thank you.
No problem. Yeah, no, I'm not aware of anything, and it's a problem, definitely. But like I said, if you do find something, think about the wheels and the motion and the movability. So there's goods and bads to all things, I think.
You're right. Good point. Thank
yeah.
you.
And perhaps if somebody has discovered something that works very well, they could share it with me, and I'll share it with everyone else. So thank you to all for your time today. It's Karen, a special thanks to you. This is obviously something about which you are really passionate and involved.
Thank you.
I'm sure glad you made this time. To all, goodbye.